The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Merrill, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Taking a fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would.
Is 2 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you will be given 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Roberta W.
Hi, everyone. My name is Roberta, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank Marty for inviting me to share tonight. I hoped when I heard his voice on the phone that he was calling for my brisket recipe, but that was not why he was calling. But I am still very happy to be here. I got sober in 1997, June the 4th, and I was 61 years old. And I have had the same sponsor, Susie S., for 23 years. Really doubted whether she would work out for me because she was way taller, way younger, and way blonder. But I tell you, it has been, that's not the way. I could never have chosen a better sponsor than him, I'm sure, than Susie. And we were just kind of pushed together. I grew up in Seattle, Washington. I have a younger sister who's also in the program. My father was an alcoholic. My mother liked over-the-counter pills, and we had a friendly physician friend who she could get, you know, pills from, the real stuff when she wanted it. I grew up frightened, bossy. I was sure that I knew everything, and I really felt that my folks just didn't quite know how to raise me. And so I just was so insistent on having my own way. One example is that when I was 9 years old, I had a friend who had left Seattle, moved to San Francisco, and I wanted to go visit her. And my parents said, "No, you may not fly alone. You're not going." And I threw myself on the floor and kicked and screamed until I developed a fever. And that was my ace in the hole, because the parents got scared and they said, okay, we'll send you. And I got on the phone to call my friend, and it turned out she had the mumps, and I blamed my parents for that too, because I couldn't go. And that is truly how I have mostly, I think I mostly lived my life that way until I had my first real drink at 21. 20, I was 20. I had just been married. It was the first time that I really had any amount of alcohol. And I had seen my dad drink daily. Every time he came home from work, it was the schnapps by the bread box and till he drank, till he passed out on the couch and that kind of thing. And I was raised by my mom, who told my sister and me that there were no Jewish alcoholics. And I'm looking at my dad on the couch and I'm thinking, well, there is one that I know of, but I didn't know of any others. I never saw other alcoholics in our circle of friends. So this was it. So this was the big family secret. This is the thing that we had to keep the neighbors from knowing. This is the thing that you didn't talk about. So what my solution to that was to keep it as secret as I could. And I to look around me at my friends and people I wanted to hang out with and to see that their lives were very different than mine and that those were the lives I wanted. I did not want my own. I could, you know, I tried to camouflage my differences. I mean, I was a Girl Scout, a brownie, a cheerleader, you know, any of the clubs, the clothes, anything that I could do to just move myself out of that, those four walls of my home and be a part of the other world where I wasn't. I got sober. I didn't think I needed to get sober. First of all, I had been drinking since I was 20. I didn't get sober till I was 61. And I didn't think I needed to. I had a career. I was a good cook. I was a good hostess. I was, you know, you could get by with me as a mother. I didn't do too well as a wife and had to divorce my husband after 38 years of marriage because he was wrong and I was right. You know, that was the reason. And so I was drinking all this time, and my kids, who by the time I was after 40 years of drinking, they were grown, and they tried to talk to me about my drinking, and I just said, I'm fine, I can take care of it. And they finally got tired of seeing me embarrass myself and embarrass them. And so they did this secret, awful intervention. And my son called me one morning and said to me, Mom, I'm having trouble with Dad. Please come with me to his therapist and we can talk. And I'm thinking, I get to badmouth my ex-husband. And I go there and he opens the door, pushes me in, and there's my daughter, there's my sister. They've been working with the therapist for a week and they read to me letters, heartbreaking letters that they have written. And the thing that got me the most was that my kid said, we'll see you, Mom. But you cannot see the grandchildren. You can't drive with them. You can't bathe them. You can't be with them when you're drinking. And that was the thing. That was my higher power kicking me, because that got my attention more than anything else ever had. There hadn't been consequences enough to get my attention like that did. So that afternoon, they drove me to a treatment center in the desert. I was there for actually for a very short time, for 2 weeks, because the insurance money ran out, and I ran to my counselor crying and saying, you know, I'll drink. I can't. It's too soon. And she said, look, you do what you've been taught here. You learn, you get a sponsor, you go to meetings, you do the steps, do what you're told to do, which is not easy for me because I think I know it all and I want to tell you what to do. That's sort of my MO. So I came home from that center and I did what I was told to do. I went to several meetings, and at one of the meetings on Ohio Street, I met my wonderful sponsor, Susie. Somebody introduced us, and she, as I say, she's been my sponsor for 23 years. And I just want to say to newcomers, I mean, I am way older than you, and I came into this program, you know, at 61, but I was a teenager in emotions, in experience. I was not a grown-up, and it's taken me 23 years here with your examples and being part of this wonderful group to grow up. I mean, it's not all done, but it's a lot better than what it was. And what else can I tell you? Just the other thing is this, that I never in my life thought I would be a divorced Jewish woman. We don't do that. Just like there aren't any Jewish alcoholics, we're not supposed to be divorced and alone. And this, I divorced my husband 20 years ago. I made it as tough as I could be and as unpleasant as I could be. And I wound up paying him alimony. But the deal was that after all these years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and without it, I could never have done it. We are good friends today. And for that, I am so grateful, because it means that my kids and my grandkids are part of our lives, all of our lives, when we get together. And I can't thank this, not just the Pacific group, but all of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I never thought that was the lamest place I could ever wind up. I never, ever expected to be in love with an organization and to have a higher power, someone I can trust and love and who will take care of me. And it sounds corny, but I swear to you, it's absolutely true. I hope that newcomers will keep coming back. I swear to you, it gets better. I wouldn't have believed it, but I do today. And I'm waiting for that bell, and I don't hear it, so it's probably broken. I'm going to have to end this pretty quick. And I think I will. And I thank you all. And thank you, Marty, for asking me. If you want my recipe, give me a call. Thank you.
Thank you, Roberta. Our second 10-minute speaker is Larry B.
Larry Bailey, alcoholic. First, give an honor to the great spirit who I choose to call God today. My sponsor is Jerry Jones, my home group is Pacific Group. Thank you, Marty, for allowing me this privilege in Alcoholics Anonymous to share my experience, strength, and hope. To those sitting in the audience today out there that are newer than me, welcome. Welcome for a new experience. Welcome for a new way of life. I truly believe that today, that if you're newer in these rooms tonight and have a desire to stop drinking, need a change in life, welcome. Thank you if you're older than me. Thank you for filling these rooms and coming back and keeping these rooms open for a person like me. That liar, that cheat, that thief, that manipulator, you know, and didn't even know it. A tornado, no matter where I went. You see, I'm a trifecta in these rooms, what we call in these rooms, jails, institutions, and death. I went flatline at 14, and I didn't think I had a problem. I went flatline on alcohol, you know, and I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol, you know. I didn't make it to the rooms until I came 39. My sobriety date is March 10th, 2007, and I really didn't come to these rooms, I didn't think, to be sober and clean. I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol, but, you know, after realizing some things that I, most of the times end up, when I say jails, institutions, and death, that I got arrested 98% of the time I was under the influence of alcohol or had started drinking. I not found a need since that date, you know, because of this institution of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor, Ozzie Gibbs, rest in peace. John Middleton, Herb King, Clancy, my current sponsor. I have not found a need because the examples that were given to me about giving me that solution to living life, giving me that solution to things when I have a problem, I don't have to go drink no matter what. These are the things I learned in here. Trust God, clean house, be of service. I thought that was really corny, like, you know, I heard Roberta say earlier. Love you, Roberta. Miss those panels we used to go on. You know, I had these things that are going on here. We talk about experience, strength, and hope. I didn't understand about how powerful words are. But think about the communications, my perception of what those words are. You can't shovel tomorrow's snow today. Stay focused. Stay in the moments. Start by doing what's necessary, then do what's possible. Then suddenly you're doing the impossible. Keep it simple. Single sunbeam is enough to drive away many shadows. And I know about those shadows because I was in a lot of dark places. A lot of times I came through those moments that I was that tornado that I created and I didn't even know that I had created the doors I had opened. I was like, why'd that person do this? Why'd that person do that? All these different times I didn't understand that about jails, institutions, and death. Why do I have to keep going to jail? Why did I have to keep going in and out of institutions? Why do I have this thinking? I'll turn a molehill into a mountain. I got a thinking problem. I got a behavior problem. It seemed that alcohol started to help with that. So it seemed. But what price am I willing to pay? See, I was emotionally numb, spiritually bankrupt. And until I came to these rooms, I had no idea that I had this here spiritual malady. I had no idea about trust God, clean house, and be of service. I had no idea about the words that were going on in my life and the things that were going on in my life and my perception, being that liar, that cheat, that thief, and manipulator, that I became that person so far delusional. You know, we talk about, you know, out there in the North 40 or something, having international calls. You see, I got this thinking problem. I got this behavior problem. You know, but I thought I had it figured out. That didn't work too well until I got a sponsor. When I got a sponsor, the first thing is you can't see the forest because of the trees. I'm right in the midst of everything, so what else can I do? You know, I said I was trying to do this. He asked me for my story, so I said, and I was open and honest. I thought he was going to be like, yeah, right, you know, and go ahead and send me out of here. See, I didn't understand that compassion. I had that sponsor that turned around and was kind of old school. Sponsor told me to take the counting out my ears and stick it in my mouth. Not quite so nice though, but I know we have women and children and families in these meetings, so I got to kind of keep it like that today. Before, I just would have said it outright, you know. My perceptions changed on so many things about how powerful words can be. How powerful the words of prayer. How powerful the steps. See, this thing called spiritual principles, the 12 that go with the 12 steps. Spiritual principles, the 12 that go with the traditions. See, the 12 spiritual principles that go with the world concepts. See, I had to have that ignition lit. See, I had this embedded in me before and I didn't even know it. The spiritual principles that I had embedded in me, don't steal today, okay? Don't lie today, okay? I'm going to tell the truth. Do the contrary action. That's what these rooms taught me. That's what those taught me that came before me, and I'm grateful for that today. I'm grateful for each and every one of y'all being here today. If you're new and you're looking for a different way of life, we can do this. First sponsor, rest in peace, the things he told me, you know, are you willing to be honest? Sure, yeah, whatever. You know, are you willing? Are you really willing to be honest? When he's talking about that, I didn't even know that I was lying. I was lying to my own self. I had too many times that trust God, clean house, be of service. That would never made that back then when I came to these rooms. To practice these principles in my affairs. I try to put that down as an order and everyday life of living now, because we talk about experience, strength, and hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. And through this experience, strength, and hope, there's solutions that we find in these rooms. Herb King used to always tell me about things like, if you understand the problem, there is a solution. You know the solution. You know, we used to do those one-on-ones. Clancy, sit down, kid. Those one-on-ones with someone else, because understanding that I can't see the forest because of the trees. Understand, I got this thinking problem. I'll turn a molehill into a mountain in a heartbeat. And I could do that today still in sobriety if I don't go ahead and work the steps. If I don't sit there and do the things I've been taught and with the solutions given through those that came before me. And guess what? I also learn from those that come after me. And for that, I'm grateful. If you're new in these rooms, if you're in these rooms, you just came in here, you have 2 days, 3 days, 10 days, 60 days, 60 years. You have a story, you can help somebody today. And I never knew that by helping somebody else, I was helping myself, and I found this word called serenity. I never knew anything about that. I thought serenity was I drink and pass out after being up for 3 weeks. You know, or having to go to jail or go to prison or go to an institute where I don't know where the hell I'm at. I thought that was serenity when they go ahead and inject me or I do a dose and medicate myself. I'm grateful today I don't have to live like that. And if you're sitting here on this screen listening to this story, you don't have to live like that today either. And I'm grateful for you being here. Put on your seatbelt. Give yourself a chance. There's a new way of life that was offered in this institution of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the big book, in the 12 and 12. That's the basis. There's a lot deeper than that, because I talked about, I found out there was a thing called root and branch that they talk about in the big book. That's the inner core of myself. When we talk about when my first sponsor said about uncovering, discovering, discarding, talking about the things going on in my life, me opening that light in, able to have that peace of mind, able to pray and actually mean it, able to say something and genuinely mean it, saying, I love you, and not just robotically saying it. The words I say today, I'm so grateful. I'm grateful for your examples, you know, through everything. You never can tell where your story may help somebody else. Now, I'm going to close with Elmer's story. I know some of you have heard this before. You know, I'm very active in the service of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, one of my hospitals and institution panels that I had used to go on, the doctor called me over for a gentleman named Elmer. You know, 78 years old. He's cussing out the doctor. Won't take his medication. They give him 3 days to live. And in this process of these giving Elmer 3 days to live, they get ready to transfer him to hospice. I'm like, what did you want me to do? You want me to just, you know, give this here, you know, bring a panel in? He was like, no, just talk. Do what you do. See, you guys taught me this. I sat down just telling my story again from childhood. Elmer, I got a thinking problem. I got a behavior problem. You see, Elmer was that 78-year-old man that was a 50-year-old hobo. I turned around and heard Elmer's story, but I have to cut it short because I only got 10 minutes. But let me tell you this. By the time I got done talking to Elmer, he asked me at the end of the day, he had quieted down, stopped throwing his hands around, ate food. He's not saying F God no more. And he's listening. So I asked him his story. It's called a fifth step, and he didn't even know it. He was giving me his inventory about what he did in his life and didn't even know it. I learned that from y'all that came before me. And he asked me if I'm coming back the next day. I said, they're going to transfer you, Elmer. You know, this is the same man saying, F God, are you coming back the next day? Yeah. And the doctors and his family saying, say yes. I said, yes, I'll be back, Elmer. Second day, I came back in. Started the same thing from like 9 in the morning till 6 at night. I got to go, Elmer. And then once again, there we go again. I'm telling my story. He's telling his story. We sitting there chopping it up. Elmer's eating. He's doing the things he's supposed to do. The same man that said F God. Okay. 78 years old, kind of frail, everything else. Comes back the third day. He asked me if I'm coming back. I said, yes, I'm coming back. Here goes the third day. I go in there. This is at Cesar Chavez, White Memorial Hospital. So I go over there, and the first thing happens, I see the family around that circle. And this 78-year-old, 50-year-old hobo had rolled over and crawled on it in a fetal position, in a prayer position, to pass away. Now, that seems like a sad story, but the understanding that story right there, you never tell where you need it and for what purpose. That's the same man that said, F God. He gave up God over 50 years ago, but he passed away in a praying position with a peace of mind. His face no longer looked all terrible. So if you're new in these rooms, once again, I encourage you, get a sponsor. Allow someone to go ahead, you know, take a look at what's going on in your life today. And if no one didn't tell you they love you, I love each and every one of y'all for suiting up and showing up and helping me in my recovery. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Our main speaker tonight is Carl M.
Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Marty and Georgia for having me here. It's a real privilege to be talking. And I got to tell you, since this pandemic started, I've been in meetings all over the country, all over the world, and There is no meeting that I love more people in one place than right here. It really is. It's just a wonderful feeling to see so many people that I love. And I'm under the illusion that love me. So anyway, there's a lot of things that I think are important in this world. And there's things that I have a lot of passion for, a lot of things that I spend a lot of time doing. But there's nothing that is more important to me than that very first sentence that I said to you guys tonight. And that's, my name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. That is the thing that has driven my bus my whole life. The fact that I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 21st, 1987. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 25 years old. Take a look. That is a while ago. That is a lifetime ago. And drunk or sober, the fact that I'm an alcoholic is really the thing that has driven my bus. The reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. It is not complicated at all. The reason that I believe I'm an alcoholic is because I've got a really bizarre relationship with alcohol. It's just that simple. I've got a strange relationship with alcohol, and that's why I'm an alcoholic. And this strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A really strange thing happens when I drink booze, and the book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink alcohol is what they refer to as something called the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It happens with absolutely nothing else that I drink. An example of that, I've got this bottle of water. And over the next exactly 33 minutes that I am going to be talking with you, Georgia, I'm watching. Over the next 33 minutes that I'm talking with you, I'll take a few sips of this. But by the end of the evening tonight, I will finish that bottle of water. But I can absolutely guarantee you that once I finish that bottle of water, I am not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in a cheap motel room. Right? There is no chance that at 3 a.m. I'm going to be texting one of you guys. Oh, man, I need another case. Right, I'll turn the pink slip in my car over. Right? It's not going to happen. But if that was the only thing, if that was the sum total of my relationship to alcohol, this physical allergic response when I drank it, if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, well, then just say no would have wiped out alcoholism, right? Early 80s. Nancy Reagan came out and said, just say no, right? And if that would have worked, I would have. And I imagine you would have gone, oh, no. And just gone on and lived a happy, successful life, just saying no. But I've got this other strange part of my relationship to alcohol. And what's really strange about this is this happens when I'm not drinking. This part of my relationship to alcohol is described by the big book as they call it the mental obsession. They also describe it as the strange mental blank spot or the thought process that precedes the first drink. And I got to tell you, this is the part of my relationship to alcohol that used to devastate and break the hearts of anybody that loved me, cared about me, or who counted on me, because they just could not wrap their head around this part of my relationship to alcohol. You see, they didn't like that allergy thing, the fact that I drank way too much, that I would drink for days on end. But at least it made sense to them. Oh, he's in the hospital because he drank for 3 days. Oh, he's arrested because he drank for 2 days, right? They get it. 2 and 2 equals 4. But they could not wrap their head around the fact that after some sort of horrific incident again with alcohol, that I would pick up another drink. They would just look at this behavior in horror and confusion. And literally the best way to describe this thing that the book calls the mental obsession in my life is that it seems like no matter how much pain and suffering I have caused on my last drunk, somehow, some way, my mind has always been able to paint a picture that made it okay for me to take another drink. My mind will always rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So therefore, because of these two components of my relationship to alcohol, number one, I cannot drink successfully because of this physical allergy. I lose control when I drink. I cannot drink successfully. But at the very same time, I cannot not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. So I swear to you, if I could do either one of those two things, either drink successfully or on my own not drink successfully, that's what I'd be doing. Wouldn't be going today. Actually, I just lied. Marty and Georgia and Golich said too, no lying, Carl. No, whatever you do, don't lie tonight. And I just lied. I just lied. I actually have no, I wouldn't drink successfully if I could. I have no interest in drinking successfully. And maybe you're like me, maybe not. But I misunderstood what drinking successfully was. So in case you don't, in case you think you might want to drink successfully, I'm going to throw this out there. I have no personal experience of drinking successfully. So I'm not going to talk from experience. But since I've been sober 34 years, I've witnessed it many times and I've read about it. And so I'm going to here to report to you what I have found out about drinking successfully. And let's see if you're interested in it. Apparently, drinking successfully entails drinking approximately two drinks and stopping. Let that sort of sink in. Two drinks and stop. I mean, that I just get nervous even talking about that. That is a nightmare situation. In fact, I would rather, we have 969 accounts. There's a number of people, there are accounts that have multiple people on there. So we've got well over 1,000 people on here. I would rather all 1,000 of you unmute your microphones and scream obscenities at me for the next hour. I would rather that happen than for me to be caught in a situation where I have two drinks in me and I can't get any more. That is literally the nightmare of my life. Two drinks in me and I can't get any more. So I also have a spiritual relationship to alcohol. And I may talk about that later. I hope I do, but I may not. But I set this relationship up with alcohol right from the get-go. When I first started drinking, I started drinking quite late compared to most people in AA. I was 11. And just a quick summary, I took a drink at 11 and I just turned into this drunken, stoned teenager in the 70s, right? Hair down on my shoulders, bloodshot eyes. My vocabulary was, whoa, hey, man. I'd call my mother, man. Hey, man. Right. And my parents didn't know what to do and they would blame my problems on people, place and things. So they're, you know, they didn't understand I was an alcoholic. So they would try to get me away from the group of kids I'm hanging out with. They would get me out of the public school system, put me into the private school system. So they're trying to change. Right. But none of that works for a guy like me. If you change the people, place and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. By the time I was 19, I barely scraped out of the public school. 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle. And my parents decided that Seattle was the problem. Get them out of Seattle. Things would get better. So they sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money and got almost 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content, about a 0.25. By the time I'm 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish. My mother was Icelandic. Therefore, I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. My parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas. And as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. Another impressive year, I'm sure. They were impressive people with impressive lives. I'm sure that paragraph was very impressive. The second paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year. And that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves to golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. I was like, really? Goodness sakes. They're actually being very kind. Long story short, about this same time, a horrific night happened. It literally was just really bad 6 to 9 months, but I'm just going to summarize it by saying a really bad night happened, so I joined the Navy. It was that bad of a night. What I'm about to tell you should concern you if you care anything about the security of the United States, but on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAB test, and this test that I took qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you that the United States Navy would have any type of system in place that would even maybe, possibly, or even remotely allow somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that particular test. That test is called a year analysis test, is what it's called. I never knew how to study for those things. Should have been kicked out of the Navy through a series of events. I was allowed to but I was allowed to stay in through a series of events, and I lost my place here for a second. Anyway, I should have been kicked out of the Navy. They allowed me to stay in, and they sent me out to the fleet instead of off to nuke school. I was sent directly out to the fleet, and now I'm out on a Spruance-class destroyer out hunting Russian submarines. And I actually started to experience some of the things that a young man is supposed to experience, where I've started to feel the camaraderie of the military. I actually started to feel like my life might have some purpose. It was really, you know, I started to understand there was honor in serving my country. But of course, I'm alcoholic, and alcoholism would laugh at a young man who is not addressing his alcoholism and thinks he's going to experience the things that life is supposed to give him. I mean, alcoholism would look at my situation and say, ha ha, I can take the love a mother has for her child. You don't think I can take this away from you? And sure enough, when that ship would pull into a port, I would take a drink. I did well when ship was out at sea, but I would pull into a port and I'd take a drink. And I was now triggering off these 3 and 4 day drunks that were baffling. And I got to tell you, when you only have 2 days of liberty, but you're on a 4 day drunk, things get dicey there. It's a very strange feeling coming out of one of these 3 or 4 day blackouts, coming to and finding myself at 6 a.m. in a foreign country on a large pier. Looking up and down that pier going, there was a destroyer here the other day. And I was already in a lot of trouble with the Navy. I'd been in the Navy approximately 2 years at this point. And I came to in a cheap motel room in downtown San Diego. I was late getting back to the ship again. My car was held together by rubber bands. I got in my car and I started racing back to the ship. And I lost control of my car right outside the Navy base and literally slid sideways through the guard shack. I can still see this Marine, that, you know, these Marines stand in the guard check. It's pre-9/11. Security was high, but nothing like it is now. And the Marine doing this big dive, and he did a quick somersault, back up, weapon drawn. Thank God those Marines are in good shape. I swear, really grateful for that. And it was one of those mornings. God, I hated these mornings. Sirens going, lots of twisted metal and broken glass, and people running and pointing at me like this is all my fault. Now, I'm sort of dazed and confused, and I'm wondering what's going on too. So I always hated it when I finally figure out, oh, I did this. And of course, I was arrested again, and the Marine was all right, but they were patching me up at the hospital for minor injuries. Hated being handcuffed to the bed. Those mornings were really bad. And of course, they were reading new charges on me, and this is nothing significant in my life. But the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called Anabuse for me. I was now under orders to show up at sick bay every single morning before quarters. And I would have to, I would sit there and I'd stick my tongue out like, and they would put that little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this thing we call alcoholism. And that is, I had no alcohol in my system, but I was literally going insane. See, ever since I've been a teenager, there had been what I like to call windows of opportunity for sobriety, right? Where at various times in my life, something happened, parents, counselors, the university, now the military would get involved because something happened. And there would be these brief days or weeks of not drinking because you're laying low. And each time, quite often, I was always put in front of well-meaning, highly educated people who always wanted to talk to me about me. They always wanted to talk to me about why I'm doing these things. And if I would have had the vocabulary during any one of these times that I was sitting in front of one of these well-meaning, highly educated people, I would have said, yes, I get it. I see that you are astonished that I am willing to pay the price for another drink. You cannot grasp that at all. I get it. But I would have followed it up with this. But if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink. You see, there's only one thing worse than the price I'm paying for my drinking. And that's the way that I feel when I'm not drinking. And I don't know when that crept in. I didn't have that as a child. As a child, I had a lot of wonder for life. But something happened and my alcoholism just started to eat away at my soul. And literally, I could not stand the way that I felt when I was not drinking. My only time that I could feel alive and connected to this world was somewhere between the fourth and fifth drink. And, you know, and I always overshoot the mark. That's just the price I pay. I lasted 10 days on that antabuse, and I went AWOL from my ship, locked myself in a little motel room in downtown San Diego, Plaza Hotel, 4th and Broadway. This would have been May of 1986. And in May of 1986, the Plaza Hotel cost about $13 a night. It's a fine establishment. I checked a couple of years ago. They've upped it to $19 a night now. And I remember sitting on the edge of the bed, looking at I had a bottle of vodka and a shot glass on this rickety little end table. And as I stared at that bottle of vodka, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of antabuse. When they had prescribed it for me, they had said, son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this antabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die. I remember looking at that bottle and I thought, I wonder what reaction I'm going to get. So I took one shot. And nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again, as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt, I was drenched in sweat, and all of a sudden, I'm like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. Any of you that are laughing at this, there's something really wrong with you. There really is. There's normal people do not laugh at a young man dying in a motel room drinking on top of antabuse. Anyway, I took another shot, and up it came. My second sponsor was a man named Eddie Cochran, literally one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. His sobriety date was December 2nd, 1951. He described the next thing that happened to me, projectile regurgitation. This is a new level of puking I'm unfamiliar with. Because we all know normal puking. It's one of the tools for living we get as alcoholics, right? You get that in the middle of a good drunk, you get that little sour taste in the back of the throat. Maybe a little bit comes up in the mouth and you kind of go, And we all know, based upon experience, we have 30 to 60 seconds to find an appropriate place to throw up. There's a bathroom. Great. If we're driving, we try to get the window down. We know that we learn as a teenager, right? When you vomit in the car, it's a bad deal. But you get the warning. But here on the antabuse, no warning. It says, sort of this Linda Blair spray across the room. Thank God the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. It's a design feature, I believe, maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But I found the magic of drinking on top of antabuse, and that is if you hang in there, and that's an important feature, if you're going to drink on top of antabuse, you cannot half measure it. You got to hang in there. In fact, if you're going to drink on top of antabuse, you might need to reach down deep inside yourself for a level of commitment you might not even know you have. But I found that if I hung in there and I kept drinking and kept puking and kept drinking and kept puking for about an hour to an hour and a half, enough of the antabuse would kick out of my system and I'd quit throwing up and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating. And I'm all right with that. Drank on top of antabuse the last 7 months of my drinking. The only words to describe this are desperation drinking. My second, my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot and I came to on an operating table. They had to do reconstructive surgery on my face. My last night of drinking, I'm being let out of the San Diego jail. I'll be transferred from civilian authorities back to military authorities. It's one of those mornings where the handcuffs are extra tight. They tried to bring me back to my ship, but that morning the officer Dick would not allow us on board. He put his arm up and said, wrong answer. Orders were processed on this loser last night. Orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, it's not like I thought treatment was a good idea. I actually now know that I didn't have a choice in the matter because I was in handcuffs. I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but my experience was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs, never once did they ever turn to me and say, so what's your opinion on what happens next? Right? When you're handcuffed, you go where they say. And they took me up to a military treatment center. And when the doors were locked behind me, that's when the handcuffs were taken off. And there's no better symbolism of who Carl Morris is without Alcoholics Anonymous than that. The country I'm supposed to be serving and the society in which I'm supposed to be living and contributing to was only willing to take the handcuffs off me when the doors were locked behind me. While I was in that military treatment center, I was taking meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what saved my life. 4 to 5 nights a week, white vans would pull up in front of those barracks, and 5 or 6 of us, maybe 7 of us, would get into a white van, into each one of those white vans, and each of those vans would take off around the San Diego County area to large open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous allows outside agencies to attend outside meetings. And, you know, the military men and women would sit in the back of those large meetings. And again, I'm sitting there at this point while I'm in this 45-day military treatment center, another window of opportunity for sobriety. But this time I'm not put in front of highly educated, well-meaning people. I'm put in front of you guys. And you guys did not want to talk to me about me. Not at all. You were basically didn't even know whether I was there or not. I could sense that as I sat in the back of those rooms listening to you. You'd be here telling that story whether I was here or not. On any given Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday that I might be sitting in that room, I could tell you'd be there telling that story whether I was there or not. And you seem to just incessantly talk about yourselves, right? Kind of like what I'm doing tonight. But in that scenario, for the first time in my life, it's like my defense mechanisms dropped down for the first time in my life, especially when you would get me to laugh. You know, you'd say, oh, I was in a bathtub and I'd already shot myself, and I'm about ready to go under it. By God, I still had my bottle in my hand, right? You know, and everybody, oh, right? And I'd catch myself laughing at crazy stuff like this. And I swear every defense mechanism I had ever built up would be down for 3 seconds. And I believe it during those couple of seconds, God could gently slap me across my face with my own alcoholism. What I'm trying to say is I believe what happened to me during those days while I was in that military treatment center and being taken to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that what Alcoholics Anonymous wants to have happen with any new person happened to me. I identified. I got out of that military treatment center with 45 days of sobriety. It was a Friday afternoon. And don't ask me how this happened, but I didn't need to be back to my ship till Monday. And they let me out of treatment on a Friday. But, you know, when I got out of that military treatment center, I knew this one thing. I knew I could get struck drunk any minute. Now, I hadn't read the book and really understood Chapter 3 in The Mental Obsession. But you know what? The reason I knew it, because it had happened 1,000 times before. I had meant not to drink and I wound up drunk. And I kind of knew that there had not been any permanent thing happen to me here. So I knew the only place I felt safe was when I was physically sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went straight to the 6 p.m. gong show meeting in Pacific Beach. And I am sitting in the back of that room. And I have 45 days without a drink. I have a lot of information and I'm physically feeling better than I have felt since I've been a young kid. And I had no idea what my life was about to embark upon. I had no idea really what I was sitting in. I had no idea that this society called Alcoholics Anonymous had a real solution for me. I knew that there were a lot of people there that seemed to drink like me, and I believed you that you were sober and happy about it. But I had no idea of the spiritual malady that I was suffering from, and that, you know, I've got about 10 minutes. I hope I can tell this story in about 6 minutes and then let you know a little bit about what today, but I really want to emphasize this. I really drove, I always emphasize the allergy, the body, the obsession, the mind, right? That I cannot drink successfully. I cannot not drink successfully. But how did that manifest itself? I believe my spirit also has an abnormal response to alcohol. And when I say my spirit, I'm talking about that thing that makes me me, that thing that's trying to talk to you right now, that thing that authors, poets, musicians, philosophers, and you know, theologians have all tried to describe and talk about, that thing that makes us us. I seem, that part of me seems to have an abnormal relationship to alcohol. And I don't know any other way to tell you what I mean, more of what I mean by that, than to tell you this story that happened 13 years later from me sitting in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. 13 years later, I had done all the things that Alcoholics Anonymous had done. I had sponsors until they died. I had commitments, home group, trying to be of service, working steps, working with others, all the things that Alcoholics Anonymous asks us to do and absolutely guarantees us that we will have a life, I had done in those 13 years. And in the year 2000, my mother calls me up and says, "Hey, Carl, your brother and his wife are spending the summer in the south of France. They have this amazing house, this like chateau, goodness sakes. And they're there for 3 or 4 months. They said, we can come for a few weeks if we want. And they'll give us a whole section of this house." You're wondering, how on earth do they get a house in the south of France for the summer? Remember, Microsoft money, ridiculous money. No resentment for me. Right. So I go, "Yeah, sounds great, Mom. Let's go." Absolutely. All the amends work had been done, reestablishing a relationship with the family that all happened in the previous 13 years. And I go, "Yeah, let's go." And she said, "And by the way, let's go early and let's go for a week to Reykjavik, Iceland. And we'll go see the family farm up in northern Iceland and this museum dedicated to your great aunt." And I go, "Hey, this sounds better by the minute. Let's go." And I had such a spectacular time in Iceland in 2000 that I've actually been back like 8 times since the year 2000. But that's not the point of the story. Point of the story happens in the south of France. And we're there having a good time. And one of the nights we're there, my brother says, "Hey, Carl, you're going to drive because you don't drink. And we're all going to go out for a 13-course French meal." And I go, okay. "And I'm going to drive. So you're paying, because this sounds really expensive, Eric." And he goes, yeah, I'll pay." And they had the nannies watch the kids. I drove, my mother, my brother, his wife. We all drive a few kilometers down the way. We were in Avignon. And we pull up at like a castle, 1,000-year-old castle in the French countryside. And the whole courtyard is turned into a, you know, I don't know how to, 5-star Michelin rated type restaurant. And we embark on a 13-course French meal. Now, I had never had a 13-course French meal before that, and I haven't had one since. But if you've never had a 13-course French meal, what they do is they bring you a tiny little bit of food 13 times. That's what they do. They bring you this tiny little bit of food 13 times. And with each one of these tiny little bits of food they bring you, they will bring even a smaller, a ridiculously, embarrassingly small little glass of wine. And the waiter will tell a story about why that wine was paired with that food, and what vineyard that wine came from, what region that vineyard is in, and what family has historically owned that vineyard, and the history behind that family. All very interesting. Now, my brother and his wife, they recognize a good drinking opportunity. They're having a blast. And they're asking questions. Hey, let's try to pair this wine with that food instead. And hey, where was that vineyard? Maybe we should go up there and try some wine tasting. Right, they're having a good time. Me, I'm already 13 years sober, so I am trying all the Diet Cokes of the region. I kept on asking the waiter to tell me a story about the Diet Coke. He seemed to get embarrassed for me. But my mother is always has been a professional non-drinker. She doesn't turn it down. And through her civic and business life, she was always in very important positions. And even into her 80s before she passed away, she'd be at these big luncheons in her honor to get, and she, she would get a Lifetime Achievement Award, and I would escort her after my father died quite a few times to these events. And, you know, she would accept the drink put in front of her, but she would just barely put it to her lips, and then she'd set it down and move it to the side and not pay attention, not make a big deal. I would notice. But it got a little awkward here at this particular table because all these little glasses of wine are piling up in front of her. She finally tells the waiter, hey, take those away, and you don't need to bring me any more. And I go, Mom, come on, I'm driving. For goodness sakes, have a little more. And she said, no, Carl, I don't like the way it makes me feel. Now, I should have left well enough alone and just continued on with the conversation. But I, for whatever reason, I decided to ask the million-dollar question. I said, Mom, tell me, how does it make you feel? And what she said changed my life that day. At 13 years sober, she said this. She said, Carl, I'm here with three of the people I love the most in the world. And I'm looking at the colors of the French countryside at sunset. And Carl, the colors, I barely have the vocabulary to describe how rich and beautiful those colors are. And Carl, I'm listening to the string quartet playing, and the music is rattling in my bones. And I'm here talking with three of the people I love the most in the world. And Carl, if I were to drink a little bit too much alcohol, the colors will start to get dull and blurry. The music will start to sound shallow and off in the distance. And I'll have a very hard time keeping a conversation going with you three. Do you get that? That's fundamentally the opposite relationship to alcohol than I have. Because what she's saying is of and by herself, she can see the colors of life. She can hear the music of life, and she can connect with God's other kids. And if she were to drink a little bit too much alcohol, it all gets dull, blurry, and sloppy. You see, me, of and by myself, I cannot see the colors. I cannot hear the music. And you are goddamn boring. You really are. You give me four or five drinks and, oh my God, do you see the handiwork of God's tapestry of colors? Do you see that? Do you hear that music? I will tell you where that cello was made, whether I know or not. I can make up the name of a German village on the spot. And you become very interesting, but not as interesting as me. And I sat there when I realized this and I go, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous did. It awakened my spirit to life without a drink. That was the point of the steps. It was the point of the fellowship. It was the point of service. That it awakened my spirit. It gave me a spiritual awakening. It just awakened my spirit to the colors and the music and God's other kids without a drink. And I'm convinced that if I don't find that in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not staying. I can't stay in that dark, cold world. I gotta have color. I gotta have love, and I gotta connect with you guys. So I've got about 2 minutes here. I got out of the military at 2 years sober. My first 2 years, I was still in the military on that same destroyer, going to meetings all over the world. You know, it was, you didn't have a meeting app. We had to find a payphone and find meetings. One of the most valuable memories of my early sobriety, finding meetings. My first sponsor was another man on my ship, and it was the perfect relationship. He was 23 years old with 16 months of sobriety. I was new, you know, and it was perfect. It was perfect. He died in 2011, and he was still 16 months ahead of me. I moved to Covina at 2 years sober. I got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. That's the result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and apparently merciful God and a personnelman that lost half my file. That's how that happened. And I have 20 seconds left. And what I'm going to use with that 20 seconds is to thank you guys for this life that I've had for the last 34 years. A lot of you are my heroes in here. So many of you have come to the Covina group and participated with us and helped our group to find the excitement and love of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope that I've done just a little bit of that with you guys. God bless, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Carl.
AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, anything that would affect you from the neck up. If your regular attendee of this meeting would like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ann, and I'm an alcoholic.
Please email her by 6:30. Otherwise, you'll have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight, and we have a special guest to sing us a happy birthday song.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear AA. Happy birthday to you.
I'm coming back. Okay, our birthdays this week are, we have Ben C. for 2 years, his sponsor's Toby M. We have Meg S. for 7 years, her sponsor is Teresa M. We have Eric G. for 7 years. His sponsor is Tim K. We have Donna D. for 9 years. Her sponsor is Kimberly K. We have Mickey C. for 25 years. His sponsor is Tom B. We have Stephen S. for 25 years. His sponsor is Tom B. We have Rich J. for 29 years. His sponsor is Tom B. We have Sonia S. for 31 years. Her sponsor is June G. We have Don P. for 45 years. His sponsor is Matt T. So we had 9 birthdays for a total of 180 years, the average being 20 years per birthday cake. Happy birthday, everybody. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contributions to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H., at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org.